You noticed how we are such creatures of habit. The announcement was made, we're using songbooks. And there was panic across the auditorium. What's a songbook? How does that work? I think just a few short years ago, we didn't know what PowerPoint was. And someday, maybe they won't have any idea what a songbook is. What a powerful, powerful prayer. Brother Perry, I hope it is not the last prayer that we hear from this pulpit, but I pray that you will give me a copy of your prayer. We love you and appreciate you, and we hope that you know that. That comes from the bottom of our hearts. And we're here today because we all love the Lord, and we just want to live a life pleasing to Him. If you're visiting with us, our one prayer is that when you leave, you'll say, those people just want to love God. Those people just want to serve the Lord. Those people just want to try to do what is right. Before we look at our text in Titus chapter 2, I want to mention there is a theory that's been around for a while. It's called generational theory. Strauss, Howe, Hanks, Rainier, and others have promoted and developed it and added to it. And there are little different variations of it. You'll see a little bit different classifications and age ranks attached to it. But basically, it looks at the differences between generations and looks at the differences in their experiences and the differences in how they handle things and how they just approach life in general. For example, you look at you have your builder GI generation that fought World War II. You have the generation that follows them that sometimes called the silence. You have the baby boomers where you have this massive explosion of births that takes place after World War II and during time of peace. You have the baby busters, sometimes called Generation X. You have the millennials, which often describes today's young people. And so any given time in history, especially now, you've got five, maybe portions of six different generations, depending on who you're reading from and what classifications they use. But it's of interest as you think about those differences. You always have to be careful in overgeneralizing things. You can't pigeonhole people or even generations or time frames. But we have to admit that people have been through different things. The GI generation endured World War II, and they dealt with the Great Depression. The baby boomers dealt with Vietnam. The millennials, the young folks today, are the most technological generation to ever come along. Generation X, the baby busters, they were the most aborted generation in all of human history. I think one in three of them have been aborted. And so each of them have been through unique experiences. And though we have things in common, we also have some unique differences because of what we've been through along the way. George Barna, in some research he did, highlights some of these differences. He said, the favorite activities reported by the baby busters were traveling off to far-off places and cooking. The boomers, on the other hand, preferred to work in their yards. He went on to say, quote, young adults are seeking fun and relational experiences. During middle age, people are more likely to focus on self-examination and personal development. And at the end of the trail, adults return to the simpler joys of life, like gardening, reading, and considering their next phase of existence. Whether you're dealing with Barna or some of these other folks, what they're trying to say is that while as human beings we have some things we share in common, we also have some uniqueness, not just in our individual personalities, but in our generations and our cohorts, where we are in the stage of life we were at. As we think about those differences, I want you to look in Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8 with me. Because I believe as we read what Titus says here, Titus recognizes the differences in where people are in life. He recognizes generational and gender differences specifically. And so as he is teaching Titus how to teach the people at Crete, he tailors what he talks about to where those people are in their stage of life. Are they older Christians? Are they younger Christians? Are they men? Are they women? And with that in mind, let's listen to what Paul has to say. He says, but as for you, speak the things which are fitting for sound doctrine. Older men are to be temperate, dignified, sensible, sound in faith, in love, and in perseverance. Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, so that they may encourage the younger women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. Likewise, urge young men to be sensible. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds, with purity in doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Now, before we look at each of these areas and look first at the older Christians and then at the younger Christians, I want to set the stage for what Paul is trying to do here and what it is he wants Titus to do. If you go back to chapter 1, he begins this letter dealing with the problem of false teachers. He specifically talks about in verses 5 through 8 that there need to be elders in each of the congregations. And as a part of those qualifications of those elders, he said they need to hold fast the faithful word. Part of the reason that they needed to hold fast to the Word of God was so that they could teach and refute those who were false teachers, so that they could teach and exhort in general in the congregation, but they could also deal with those who were false teachers. And he specifically talks about these false teachers. Look in verse 16 of chapter 1. It says, "They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny Him." In other words, it's not enough to say I know God. If I really know God, you will see it in the way I live my life. And so basically he then follows that up, this section talking about teachers who teach what is false and who live what is false, and then says to Titus, now you don't teach what is false. I need you to teach what is true. And here's what people who truly know God actually live like and look like. And he emphasizes this word sound again. You'll see it three times in the text that we're looking at. And remember, that's a medical term that has to do with a healthy or whole body, like a bone that's healthy and sound. And he uses it to describe spiritual things, especially soundness in faith and one's walking with God, soundness in teaching and so forth. And so he generally just kind of introduces this section by saying, you speak things which are fitting for sound doctrine. We've got these teachers out there who are teaching what is not healthy for the congregation. He says, in contrast, Titus, you teach what is healthy. And if you'll teach what is healthy, then there's a greater likelihood that the people who hear your message will then be spiritually healthy. And so then he begins to describe, here's what spiritual health looks like for older Christians. Here's what spiritual health looks like for younger Christians. So let's just hit some of the highlights of what he says in this section, and then this lesson will be yours. First of all, he starts off talking about the older men. It's interesting, the word that is used here for older men is the same word from which we get the word elder. And so it could be used at times for older men in general, or it could be used specifically of a group of older men who fill an office of leadership within the church. Here, in this context, he seems to be referring to older men in general, especially when it's contrasted to older women, younger men, etc. What I also want us to notice is that a number of the things that are listed here, at least some of them, are also listed in the qualifications of elders. And sometimes we forget that when we look at elder qualifications or deacon qualifications, that when we start looking elsewhere in the Bible, many of those same characteristics are required of all of God's people. There are a few of them that are unique to the office of elder or unique to the office of deacon, but most of them can be found other places applied to all of us. And so really, anytime I'm looking at a qualification list, really a characteristics list of elders, I need to also be looking at myself. Because it's real easy to say, okay, you're going to be an elder maybe, so do you act like this? Well, really the message of the Bible is we all ought to act like this. It's just that elders and deacons need to be exemplary, especially in these particular areas. So I just want to mention that kind of as a broad statement as we enter in. I also want us to remember that as he's dealing with these older men, The leaders of the congregation are going to especially and primarily come from this group. And so it shouldn't surprise us that there are a lot of similarities. But notice the terminology he uses. Words like temperate, dignified, sensible, and sound. The terms, for example, the word sensible here, he's going to use over and over throughout this list of characteristics of a healthy person spiritually. It has to do with the idea of being self-controlled, having sound judgments, fair treatments of people in life. So it's this idea of I think with common sense and soundness. I have my life under control. Well, that's very important because, again, if this is going to be the group that is going to play a pivotal role in leading the congregation, they need to have sound judgment. They need to be self-controlled. They need to carry themselves with dignity in those things. Now, sometimes we think, you know, we start looking at these kind of words, respectable, dignified, and all those kinds of things. It almost gets the picture of somebody who can't ever laugh and have fun. That's not what he's talking about. He's not saying you don't have joy in life and you can't laugh and so forth. Because you're going to have a hard time when Paul says, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. Okay? And so, joy is a part of the Christian life. He's not saying you walk around with a sad face all the time. But it means that you understand that there are serious things in life and there's a time to be serious and to take things seriously. It means especially you take your relationship with God seriously, your position of leadership in the Lord's church seriously, and you carry yourselves with a dignity. In other words, even in the area of having fun, there's a way to have fun in a dignified way, and there's a way to have fun in a way that's not dignified. And so there's just a way that they carry themselves that speaks of self-control, seriousness, dignity. It's a person that is living life in a close relationship with God and takes that relationship very, very seriously. And he sums it up by saying sound in faith, love, and perseverance. And we're reminded that Paul often emphasizes this triad of faith, hope, and love. And he doesn't have the word hope here, but perseverance and hope are regularly connected in Paul's writings. And so he says, I want our older men to be healthy in their faith. And most think here he's talking about their personal relationship with God. He wants them to be healthy in their love for others. And he wants them to be healthy in the perseverance they show. It's the idea of being patient and steadfast in the face of obstacles. Now, why is that especially important? Because these are going to be generally the men who are leading the congregation. And so if they are sound in their faith and in their love, if they are able to stand strong and weather the spiritual storms of life, then the troops following them, the other members of the congregation, are going to be more apt to have sound faith, love, and steadfastness in the face of obstacles. And again, it should remind us that while there will be certain men in this group who will serve as elders, God wants all the men in this group to live this lifestyle. So if I'm in this age group, I'm not, but someday, Lord willing, I will be. If I'm in this age group and maybe I'm not appointed by a congregation as an elder, I still need to live a life that is exemplary, a life that can be followed, a life that is sound in faith, love, and steadfastness. He then talks about the older women. As he talks about them, he says, reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, not enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good. And we're reminded that as he goes through these, he doesn't have a one-size-fits-all approach. He recognizes the different experiences of each group. I think he also recognizes the local Cretan culture and their culture. In other words, many times Paul in his dealing with problems or in his suggestions as to how people should live, he's directly countering problems in their local culture. And so some of the things he talks about relate to what's going on with older women or younger women or older men or younger men in the culture in which he is teaching. That doesn't mean it is not applicable to us. We just need to be aware of that going in, that it also and originally applied to what was going on in their world. He talks about being reverent in their behavior. That's an interesting term because it's a term that was used for the temple. It's a term that was often used for the priesthood and the sacrifices. And really the idea is to carry yourself with a sense of holiness. Just as the priests conducted themselves in the temple or the tabernacle prior to that, and just as there was to be a holiness and a respect and reverence for God, that is the way older women are to live their lives. One writer described it as, it's a person who lives their life in such a way that it's obvious that they take their service to God, as a priest would serve in the temple, very, very seriously. And so they have a reverence in their life towards God that is evident, not necessarily just in what they say, but in the way they live especially. It talks about not being malicious gossips. And gossip was a problem in the first century. I mean, you can go over in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 11 when he was talking about the qualifications of deacons' wives. Remember those characteristics. He mentions almost exactly the same phrase. Literally, the idea is being a slanderer. The word that is used here is the word diabolos. It's from which we get the word diabolical. But one of the most destructive things in human existence is gossip and the human tongue. We talked about that recently in a Sunday night sermon, but he just emphasizes being very careful in the use of the tongue because it can destroy lives and congregations. Not enslaved to much wine. What we know about ancient Crete is that drunkenness was a major problem on this island. In fact, remember, one of the things we talked about is that this as a whole was a very wicked island. In chapter 1, Paul says that one of their own, you know, prophets or poets said they were liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. In other words, one of them tried to sum up the attitude of his whole island, and that's what he said. In fact, we talked about that lying was so prevalent on this island that when you called somebody a Cretan, became equivalent to calling them a liar. So they've got all kinds of problems, and drunkenness was a part of it. Also, Chrysostom, who lived in the 4th century in the 300s, he came along about 300 years after Paul wrote this letter to Titus. He talked about that the medicinal use of wine was very common in the ancient world among the older members of society. In other words, the elderly tended to use wine medicinally quite frequently in the ancient world. And so there was a need for Paul to encourage them to exercise caution even when it was used in that regard. But I especially want to notice what he says here about teaching what is good. A lot of psychologists and others, recently I was doing some reading on what happens to people in the middle age years. I'm in that age span now. And one of the things that a lot of them talk about is this idea of generativity. It's basically the idea that as you move into the middle age years, you begin to think about what you're going to leave behind. Okay, now I don't know if everybody experiences that, but I do think a lot of folks that are my age and give or take 10 years either way and beyond, but I do think as you move into middle years, I think a lot of us probably in the audience, you've started thinking about, you know, what am I leaving behind? One of the reasons we have these preacher training camps in the summer is because we're thinking about what are we leaving behind. And so as people move into the later stages of life, they begin to think about the impact they're having on future generations, training future generations. And so it's interesting to me that I can go back in time 2,000 years, and Paul says that's what ought to happen, that those who are older ought to be thinking about generativity, training, teaching, and bringing on the generations that are coming along behind them. And he specifically encourages the older women to teach the younger women. And I just want to emphasize that I would challenge us to look for ways to mix the generations. We in our modern culture have become a people who tend to stratify by age a great deal. Okay, we have K-5 activities. We have teenage activities. We have our college and young professional activities. We have our middle agers activities. We have our senior saints activities. We stratify our fellowship activities by those groups. We stratify our Bible classes by those groups. And sometimes the only time we're together in a multi-generational setting, it's in a setting like this where we don't talk to each other a whole lot. Well, Paul says there is a need here. He's talking about older women, but I think it applies across the board, especially when we consider when he's talking to older men, many of them were elders, and one of their jobs is teaching the younger generations. And so I think we make a strong case that it applies to men and women, though in this particular verse he's talking about the women. But there, I think, is a great need. I'm not saying we can't have fellowship by group. I'm not saying that we can't have some Bible classes by group. But I'm just saying that we miss something valuable when we don't mix the generations. When a 16-year-old can't sit down with a Milton Perry and learn from his years of experience, then we have lost something in our society and we've lost something in the Lord's church. And what I see is the extent this happens in the church is that what generally happens is the older young adults and the middle-agers teach the younger young adults and the teenagers and the children. And I would challenge us, and when I say us, I'm not necessarily just talking about Graymere, in the church as a whole, and as it applies to us, then do it here as well. But I would encourage us to look for opportunities to get older Christians into settings where they can teach the younger Christians. Okay? Because I find what time, sometimes we feel like, I've had folks who are older Christians say to me, well, I don't feel like I'm in touch anymore. I don't feel like I can relate anymore. You know, being a mom is different now than it was then. Well, there are going to be differences in culture and technology as time passes. But there's a lot of the same things mothers deal with that are not only the same as they were 80 years ago, they're the same as they were 2,000 years ago and 4,000 years ago. That's why the Bible can be filled with all these stories about people and it still be relevant 2,000 years later in the case of the New Testament, or more than that in the case of the Old Testament. Because some human conditions are the same throughout time. And so there's value in a woman who's 80 years old being able to sit down with a new mama who's 22 and say, you know, here's what I did to deal with being a new mom. You know, I married when I was 15, she might say. And I had a baby on the way, you know, when I was 16. And you know, and I had four kids by the time I was 21, and here's what we did to deal with that. And the ages may be different, and the technology may be different, but children are children. And they still need to be loved and nurtured and cared for. Problems arise, and they have to be reacted to. There's great treasure in learning from somebody who's already been down that road. So I would challenge those of us who play a role in planning and organizing to organize more opportunities to mix the generations. And I would challenge those who are older Christians to look for more opportunities to mentor those of us who are younger than you. Okay? I need your mentoring. And there's a whole lot of us that need your mentoring. So stop by our offices. Stop us in the hallway. Invite us over to your house for dinner. Or encourage us to invite you over to our house for dinner. Sit down and help us to know how we can be a better servant of God because of the experiences that you've gone through and the things that you have learned. We'll pick up there next week. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? You may have noticed recently in the bulletin, I talked about an email, and I don't remember who it was that sent it to me. Somebody sent me an email in which they started off with a list of questions. Things like, you know, can you mention the last five Super Bowl winners? Can you mention the last five or six women to be Miss America? Can you mention the last, I don't know, 10 Nobel Prize or Pulitzer Prize winners? And as I read through that list when I got the email, and maybe as you read it when we put it in the bulletin, you began to think, you know, who did win the last few Super Bowls? I can still remember the Giants won last year, but I can't remember beyond that. Okay? I couldn't make you a list of the last five. Maybe some of you can. And how many Miss Americas could you list? Okay? We've got one from Columbia, so we could probably all get her name. Beyond that, I don't even know where to start. Okay, and you think of all of these famous folks in our lifetimes who've won these prestigious awards, Heisman trophies, and all kinds of things. Okay, you know, we got folks that religiously watch American Idol. Do you know the top 10 from last season? Now, some of you may know one or two, but I want you to think how you would struggle to make those lists. But then the second list started asking questions like, "Tell me a teacher who had an impact on you when you were in school." Or tell me somebody who taught you a life lesson or somebody that made a difference in your life. And my guess is, while I may not know who the last five Super Bowl winners were, I can remember the people who mentored me and impacted me in my life. I got a phone call yesterday, and I'm going to be doing a funeral in Nashville on Tuesday. Mama J, Sister Johnson, Brother and Sister Johnson, Brother Pete preached at the Pennington Bend Church of Christ in Nashville, Tennessee, and he was director for 15 years of the Future Preachers Training Camp. That's where I learned to do camps, and that's where the model for our doing our camp came from. For 15 years, Mama J was the camp mother. She fed us. She fixed our wounds when we needed a Band-Aid. She consoled us when we were homesick and away from our moms for the first time. Tuesday, I'm going to be with some other guys who used to go to the camp helping the family say bye to her. I'll never forget Mama J. I will eventually forget all the MVPs of the Super Bowl. But I'll never forget Mama J. Because she invested in my life. She decided I'm going to leave a little bit of me behind in the life of a young boy from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. And I really think that's what Paul's talking about as he talks to those older Christians. There are a lot of folks who will never remember all the superstars and rich people of this world. But they'll remember you if you'll invest your life and your spiritual life in them. I want to challenge all of us to find one person at least that we can mentor for God before we leave this planet. Helping each other is one of the great blessings of the Christian life. We have an invitation at the end of our sermon. It's not the only time you can come forward, but it's an ideal and opportune time. And what is opportune about it is it's an opportunity for us to help, encourage, and mentor each other. If you come forward and want to become a Christian, we get to share with you in that. If you express your faith and repentance, confession, and baptism, then a host of folks from all ages get to share in that moment. They get to hug your neck. And 40 years down the road, they'll be able to say, you know, I remember the day. And then some of them will step forward as mentors to help you walk with God. If you want prayers this morning, then a potential mentor, one of our elders, is going to lead that prayer. But he's not only going to pray that God would help you with the sin you're dealing with or a physical problem, whatever it is you want him to pray about, but he as a shepherd is then going to be there for you to help walk you through it. What a blessing. Let's take advantage of it right now as we stand and sing.